As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
This is The Athletic Baseball Show on The Athletic Podcast Network.
Hello, everybody. Hopefully your week is off to a great start on this Monday. Welcome to another edition of the Athletic Baseball Show. Tim McMaster here, along with Ken Rosenthal, as we do every week, taking your questions in the mailbag. Ken, you're back out on the West Coast this weekend. How's everything going?
Everything's great, Tim. How are you?
I am good. And you know, Ken, I know there's two players you wanted to talk about today, and there's a tie between the two. So this is how we're going to get there. 10 years ago, Manny Machado made his big league debut for the Baltimore Orioles, kind of brought with him this era of competitive baseball for Baltimore. Buck Showalter was there. They were a good team for a lot of time. Then they traded Machado, which kind of brought in the era of tanking that we're currently in and they're hoping to nearing the end of. But this week, the Orioles have called up Adley Rutschman, and I think the hope is that like Machado's arrival 10 years ago, Adley Rutschman's arrival will at least start the climb of this Orioles team to contention. I know you don't want to talk about them in that light, but I just think it's interesting that the Orioles are here they are again 10 years later, although further away than they were when Manny Machado came up.
Tim, actually, that's a great point and a great link between the two, both number one picks, of course, and both coming to the Orioles with great hope. Now, to start this, I want to mention that a lot of Orioles fans think, going back to my days at the Baltimore Sun, which ended 22 years ago, that I have it in for the Orioles. I don't have it in for the Orioles. I have it in for bad baseball. And teams that play poorly generally get written about more critically than teams that are very good. That's kind of the way this works. So I do not have it in for the Orioles. And actually, having lived there for so long, I don't live there anymore, but I did for quite some time, and having experienced what a great baseball summer can be like in Baltimore, I was actually quite excited yesterday to see Rutschman come up, to see the way he handled it, actually to see first the call-up video in which his manager, AAA, Buck Britton, Zach Britton's brother, gave him the news. And this was not the first such video we've seen just this year. These have become rather commonplace. Julio Rodriguez, Bobby Witt Jr., I love these videos. I think all fans probably do. And this one was really good as well. And then when Rutschman made his debut, to see him walk to home plate, shake the umpire's hand with his catcher's gear on as he gets ready to catch his first inning, and then kind of circle himself around to take a look at the crowd and soak the moment in, he said he had been told by others to do that. That was just a really outstanding moment in the game. We have them every day in the sport. It's one of the great things we love about baseball, just the cool things that happen that are different every day. So I would advise people to read up on Rutschman. Dan Connolly of The Athletic has written some brilliant stories about him. He is their shining light, and yet he is not their only shining light. They have some pitchers that are coming too. Kyle Bradish already up. Grayson Rodriguez, D.L. Hall. These two are coming as well. And the way the Orioles see it, those three names I just mentioned, Those are the kinds of guys with the stuff to compete in the AL East. They might not do it right away. There are going to be ups and downs for all of these players, I'm sure, Rutschman included. We've seen Jared Kelnick struggle. We've seen all kinds of young players have non-linear paths to success. But for Orioles fans who have waited forever, it seems, for this all to happen, yes, it is very exciting. And it was really cool to see Rutschman do what he did yesterday. And sure, as you mentioned, Tim, there is a link to Machado as the two former number one picks. And I watched Machado for the second straight week on FS1 this week. I had them last week in Atlanta, the Padres, and then this week in San Francisco, the tail end of this road trip, which has been very successful for the Padres. And Machado is playing at a level that we've never seen him play before. And that's high praise, considering Machado has played at a high level, really, his entire career. His first year in San Diego, he tailed off. It wasn't so good. He wasn't happy with it. But overall, this has been a terrific player throughout his career. And now he has put it all together at a time when Tatis is not, obviously, available to them. Ryan Flaherty, one of their coaches and a former teammate of Machado's in Baltimore, told me that he thought for sure Manny would be swinging at everything in the first month, trying to compensate for Tatis, when in fact, Manny's been just as good as Manny has always been. His base running on point, his defense always excellent, and it's really something to see him grow into the player he is now at 29. Now, I know there are a lot of fans out there who just don't like him, who remember the antics from the 2018 postseason, maybe the Pedroia injury, maybe some other things as well. And hey, as I said on the broadcast yesterday, I was the one who conducted that infamous Johnny Hustle interview in which Machado said, basically, he's not going to run down the line for show. That's not him. He's not what he's about. Took a lot of criticism for that. As much as I tried to explain the full context to people, I wrote about it the night before, I wrote about it subsequently, the comments were what they were. That said, I said this on TV as well, it's very reminiscent to me of the criticism that Robinson Cano used to take when he was with the Yankees in his prime. Cano didn't always run hard to first, and yet Cano, like Machado, drew respect from teammates and opponents alike for one thing. And the way baseball players put it, he posted. Manny Machado posts. And what that means is he's in the lineup every day. And I'll give you this stat, and that'll prove it to you. The people who say, he's a dog. A dog? Well, since 2015, this player has played in the most games of anyone in Major League Baseball along with Paul Goldschmidt. Machado and Goldschmidt are tied for the most games played since 2015. That is what you want, folks, and he's doing it, and he's doing it at a level that really not even those who have followed him closely over the years have seen. So kudos to Machado, kudos to Rutschman, and on to the mailbag we go.
On to the mailbag we go. I think if there was an MVP award for the first 6 weeks of the season, Manny Machado would get it in the National League. We'll see how the rest of the way goes. Let's go to that mailbag.
Hey, this is Ken. Not available right now, please leave a voicemail.
All right, the first one's coming from north of the border, Eric in London, Ontario. He says, my question is about the future of the youth movement in Toronto and how will Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro sign and retain some of these guys like Bichette, Vladdy, Gurriel Jr., Teoscar, especially Espinal. Some of these guys are going to ask for huge contracts, and they may be contracts that push them out of the organization. How do the Jays front office do a magical financial dance going forward?
It shouldn't have to be magical, first of all, because if the Jays are good, and we expect them to be good now for a few years, they're set up that way, they're going to draw. If you remember, 2016, 2017, they were over $3 million. They were in the top five in the majors in attendance. And if you go way back to the 92-93 era, they were number one in attendance. So Toronto is a baseball-crazed town, actually, even with hockey and all the other things people can do in Toronto, which is one of the great cities in the world. There is an amazing passion for the sport and for the Jays. So if they're good, they'll draw. That is going to be something that will ease any so-called financial burden, which I'm not sure they have anyway. They're owned by this massive media company. They're okay. But you're right. they are in a position where they're going to have to make some decisions. Now, I'm going to go through this with you and explain just how this is staggered. So after 2023, their free agents will include Ryu, Chapman, Gurriel, Lourdes Gurriel Jr., and Teoscar, who you mentioned. Those guys are all free after 23. Kikuchi is free after 24. Bichette and Guerrero after 25. Springer, Gossman, and Espinal after 26. I don't see Espinal as a pillar of the franchise, but he's a useful, good player, and I can understand why fans like him. So the good news is these free agent eligibilities are staggered. The difficult part is going to be sorting through them and figuring out which ones you can keep, which ones will want to stay. Some might want to go free agent and have their choice of where they want to play. That's the next challenge for the Jays. It's, as baseball people will say, a good problem to have. They've got too many good players. They can't keep them all. We know that. But they will, I'm sure, continue kind of just going through it and figuring out where they are and making the choices they feel are best for the franchise.
Be interesting to see if they can convince one of the, you know, the real faces of that franchise to sign something before free agency and lock him up long term. We'll be able to see it. We see it every once in a while nowadays. All right, next question comes from the voicemail.
Hey guys, two questions, one probably easier than the other. First one is, do you think the deadening or standardizing of the weight of the ball is, and combined with the pitch clock that we know is coming, is a bid by MLB to avert our 3-2 outcomes future potentially and put more balls in play? And two, do you think that offensive struggles over the next potentially couple of years are worth that? Do you think it will cause teams to meaningfully invest in players that are more contact and base running and potentially defense driven than sluggers that strike out a lot and or Joey Gallo types? All right, thanks so much.
Excellent questions. And the idea of deadening the ball. And if you go back, remember, after the 2020 season, baseball decided they would deaden it slightly. And then last year, they couldn't get the supply of balls completely to be consistent. So they had half of the balls from 20, half the balls from 21. And this year, it's all of the deader balls. Now, that combined with the use of the humidor in all 30 parks this year, an increase of, 20 parks or so from before, that is what has led in April to what we've seen as far as a deadening of the ball, an effect on offense. Now, it's May. We talked about this last week. Offense is up a little bit so far this month. I expect if we looked at the data from this week, it would be up again. We saw a lot of home runs hit this week. Trevor Story hit most of them, it seemed like. So I am not ready at this point to say definitively that the ball is deader, offense is down, etc. But to your point, and it's a great point, great question, that is the idea of deadening the ball and installing the humidors to an extent to, one, get more consistency, and two, yes, to reduce the propensity of the three true outcomes and to get the game back to a place where the ball is in play. That is definitely something baseball wants. And the deadening of the ball, part of the motivation was to do that. Now, as we reduce the sizes of pitching staffs and pitchers, in theory, have to go longer, maybe that will have a subsequently good effect on offense as well. So the question you ask about, well, is it worth it? I'm not sure we're looking at a few seasons of this. We may be looking just at 1 month of it, essentially. So I don't know, again, if I can make any or anyone can make any definitive statement until we have more of a sample from this season. Now, I will say this. As I travel around the country from park to park each week, talk to players, they are still complaining about the ball, not only that it's deader, but the consistency of it. They will tell you, players will, one day it's this, the next day it's that, one day it's soft, the next day it's hard. I don't understand how this is happening. Baseball will tell you, because the balls are handmade, that there is a range of consistency you're going to get. Anyone can understand that. We all know it's going to be a little different ball to ball. What the players will say is it can be at times a lot different. And I will say it again, at some point, Major League Baseball has to get a grip, so to speak, on the composition of the ball and get it to a point where it is at least consistent day to day, inning to inning, and season to season.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Joey Gallo picked on a little bit in that last question, and he finds his way into the next voicemail, too.
Hey, Ken. Frank from Cleveland here. I watch a lot of Yankee games, and two swings I've been looking at in particular belong to Joey Gallo and Aaron Hicks. It just seems like there are so many moving parts in their swings, and I'm wondering when the game of baseball happened to evolve from going from more simple and compact swings to these swings with just so many moving arms and legs and herky-jerky styles. What's the benefit of all that moving? Wouldn't it just make more sense to have a simpler approach to the baseball? Thank you very much.
All right, Frank, I'm not going to get on you here, but I'm going to say this. And I'm like this too as a fan, so I'll criticize myself as well. We're all hitting coaches. We're all pitching coaches. We're all managers. Everyone is an expert on this sport, and the reason for that, and it's actually one of the cool things about the sport, is because we all played it as kids. We all look at these guys and say, why can't they do this? Why can't they do that? Now, I am not a hitting coach. I am not an expert on this kind of thing, and I don't pretend to be. In each player's case, they have their individual swings. Now, they can change from time to time. Players can adjust, no question about it. But I'm not sure that is the problem, excess movement with Hicks and Gallo. I'm not sure it isn't. So, generally speaking, yes, the short compact swing is seemingly more efficient. But this is not a cookie-cutter business. Each player has his own particular characteristics and his own things that he does to make himself successful. Now, you can say what you want about Joey Gallo and Aaron Hicks and any other hitter you see that is struggling. These guys are among the 750 best players in the world. Actually, it's a greater number than that now. It's 26 times 30, whatever that is, instead of 25 times 30. But that's my point. They're among the best in the world, okay? They're the best. Now, not all of them are going to be Mike Trout. Not all of them are going to be Manny Machado, any superstar you might name. Some will struggle more than others. I struggle with the idea that we, as fans and media, know how to fix them. I can write about them, and I can ask questions about them, but I don't know how to fix them. So, Frank, I'm not trying to get on you, but I don't know that there's a cookie-cutter approach to any one aspect of the sport.
Next question is from Adam, and he's referencing Ken last week. He says, your comments this week on pitching staff size limits, 14 to 13, and maybe eventually 12-pitcher limits, got me thinking, do you think that we will see an uptick in two-way players in the coming years? I'm not saying suddenly there's going to be an Ohtani on every team. He, of course, is a once-in-a-lifetime player. But rather, could teams try to get some of their pitchers who know their way around a batter's box into two-way eligibility and therefore not count towards the pitcher limits? For example, is there a world where the Diamondbacks are eliminated from playoff contention? There's definitely a world for that. With more than 20 games left in the season. So Bumgarner gets some time in as DH, just so that next season they have the competitive advantage of an extra pitcher on the staff.
Adam, I like the way you're thinking. It makes a lot of sense. And as you mentioned here, allude to, there is a rule in place for two-way eligibility, a standard that has to be met in a current season or the previous season. And if that standard is met, the player will not count against the pitcher limit. And that's what will enable Ohtani and the Angels to use him in that fashion, not counting against the pitcher limit. Now, If we go to 13, well, we're going to 13. If we go to 12, a 12-man pitcher limit per roster, I would expect, yes, that there might be an increase in teams trying to take guys who maybe pitched in college and high school and saying, listen, this might be a better path to the big leagues. You might be more valuable to us if you could somehow be good enough to attain two-way eligibility. The amazing thing about Ohtani, the beauty of Ohtani, is he is so good, he almost warps our perspective of what is possible. I don't know that anyone but Ohtani can do this, and that's what makes him so special. But at the same time, we've seen guys, Brendan McKay of the Rays, others as well, who have been two-way players in the past and maybe could be in the future. Jared Walsh from the Angels was another one. So I like the idea. Now, I had an interesting conversation with an executive just 2 days ago about the pitcher limits and going from 14, which is where it is right now for this month, to 13 at the end of the month. First time we'll have a limit of 13, and then possibly to 12, maybe even below that in the future. This executive is sort of panicked about this idea. And the reason for that is because that's not the way pitchers are trained today. They're trained to go in shorter bursts, and this is part of the problem, right? They throw as hard as they can for as long as they can, and that's it. So if we established a limit of 12, let's use that as an example, and you had to stretch out pitchers more, relievers had to pitch more innings, starters in particular had to pitch more innings, which I think would be good for the game, then his point is, hey, we're going to have some collateral damage initially. We're going to have more pitchers getting hurt. We're going to have a whole problem on our hands. I understand that, but the whole point of this, in my opinion, and why I am an advocate of this, even going to 12, is to reestablish the value of the starting pitcher in particular and force pitchers to do more than just specialize and do more than just throw as hard as they can for an inning or two, and that's it. So it's an interesting question going forward. The two-way idea you mentioned is really interesting, Adam, and it will be something to see if teams kind of try to get around the limits by developing more players of that kind.
Great question. This one is a where are they now question from James. Says, what happened to Rick Porcello? I can't believe he threw his last pitch at 31 years old. My suspicion is he took a page from the Jermaine Dye playbook and said, I'm either paid this or I retire, rather than there being no interest in him. But I have no idea.
I don't know that either. I don't know why Porcello has not pitched since 2020. He had a 5.64 ERA in 12 starts for the Mets that year. Did not play in 21, and now he's 33 and is not signed again. Now, I did speak with a friend of his last night, and the friend told me I wouldn't rule out Rick Porcello pitching again just because he's so young. He may decide one day, hey, I'd like to get back in. Now, you ask about if he simply wanted too much money to play, and when he didn't get that particular offer, was that it for him? I don't know that. I sort of doubt that in a sense, because what we never know is all the things going on in players' lives. And I'm not trying to excuse certain conducts or anything like that, but there is often more than meets the eye. And it could be something family related. It could be simply a guy is burned out from the game. These guys play from the time they are very young, and they play at a high level, and they play all the time. And it's not for everyone, right? We're all different. So I wouldn't make any assumptions about Porcello until we hear from Porcello about why he might have chosen to step away. I'm certain, yes, he could have gotten a minor league deal somewhere, but maybe he didn't want to do that. Maybe he didn't even want a major league deal at, say, I don't know, $2, $3 million a year. He just felt it wasn't worth it at this stage of his life. He could do other things. I don't know. But I always caution fans, especially, not to just throw blanket assumptions on players when, in fact, we don't always know the whole story.
Last couple of years, you had the protocols with COVID and all the complications of that. Might not wanted to deal with that. Who knows, right, Ken? I mean, there's so many different things.
That's a great point, Tim.
John in Michigan says, a few years ago, I read an article about a new type of hat that pitchers can wear, which has padding inside the hat and can protect pitchers if they are hit in the head by a line drive. I don't remember seeing any pitchers wearing that type of hat. Did this product ever make it to Major League Baseball? And if not, was it used in the minor leagues? Has there been any discussion about pitchers wearing a helmet or some type of protection similar to what that was a few years ago or what third base coaches sometimes wear? I know it is a rare occurrence, but there are usually one or two pitchers hit every year and they're always scary incidents.
John, I agree. And back in the year 2000, I looked this up today, the year 2000, this is 22 years ago, I had just started the Sporting News. That is when Bryce Flory got struck in the face, if you remember. That was a terribly scary incident. And I wrote a column in the Sporting News saying baseball has to do something. And I asked the commissioner at the time, Bud Selig, about this, and he said, there's nothing we can do. It's just the nature of the sport, and that is the risk that is out there. He wasn't trying to be callous, though he might have sounded that way. He was simply saying, I don't know the answer here. And I talked to some pitchers as well. Mike Mussina was one of them. And they agreed that it's a terrible problem because theoretically a tragedy could occur, but they didn't see any way around it. Now, in the year 2014, this is 14 years later, a company came up with that oversized cap, if you remember, that had a lining in it. And it increased the size of the cap, and Alex Torres of the Rays wore it. He had been scared by an incident with Alex Cobb, his teammate at the time, when Alex Cobb had gotten hit. That particular cap did not take off. It didn't look very good at all. Players do care about that, like we all care about looking good. And it just didn't catch any kind of momentum. After that, there was a Kevlar padded hat that came into play in 2015, and a greater number of pitchers wore that. It was still only a handful. I think there were six of the pitchers that tried that one. And there are other products, as far as I know today, that are available, but I don't know that many pitchers use them. And it's a comfort thing. It's a question of just adapting the technology and all of these things. We seem to have the technology, but it's comfort. It's all of that too. And as far as a helmet's concerned, that's never going to happen. It's just not practical for a pitcher. They will tell you that. But I share your concern. I have always feared that one day something tragic is going to happen, and then everybody's going to say, hold on. I have always feared that one day something tragic is going to happen, and then everyone will say, oh my gosh, why didn't we look at this sooner? That said, it's very rare when this does occur, when you have this kind of frightening situation. It's probably once or twice a season. And as far as I know, if you've got 110 miles an hour coming back at you, I don't even know that any of these padded caps that have been developed would help. So it's one of these things that you think about, you worry about. I'm not sure still that there is an answer. And I will continue checking on this. You've kind of piqued my curiosity. I will ask around and hopefully give you an answer on a future podcast about whether more pitchers are wearing padding. Maybe they're doing it, maybe they're not. I don't know. I know, of course, they're wearing the PitchCom little straps in their caps this year, but that's not what we're talking about here. So good question for sure.
Baseball's done a lot to protect the fans in recent years with all the extra netting, but those players, it's kind of up to them. All right, next question. Ken, you know, there's nothing like a good war calculation question, and that's what we have coming in from Chris. Says, I've been thinking about war and how it's calculated and how an adjustment should be made now that the DH is in both leagues. It's my understanding that a negative D war value is credited to a player when in the lineup as a DH. This makes sense when you look at it from the perspective that a DH represents and a player who's probably a below-average defender getting chances late in their career to continue to hit. However, now that we have the universal DH, one could argue that it's more about a pitcher's inability to hit than a hitter's inability to play the field. My point is, I feel that we may end up with perfectly capable players being unjustly credited with negative D war because somebody has to play the DH position. Take Corey Dickerson, for example. A Gold Glove winner was signed this offseason to serve as the left-handed side of a DH platoon in St. Louis, even though he's more than capable of playing an outfield position.
This is an interesting question, and I had to give it some thought. So Dickerson is kind of an exception. He plays on a team that has two Gold Glove outfielders from last year, Harrison Bader and Tyler O'Neill, and another good defensive outfielder, Dylan Carlson. So, yes, he is somewhat getting punished because he's unable to get on the field as a defender, not because of his own deficiencies per se, but really as much because of the skill of the Cardinals outfielders. That, however, is a pretty exceptional circumstance, I think. I don't know that it's going to happen very often, and usually the DH penalty, quote-unquote, that you see for players is warranted because they're not good enough defensively to get on the field. And if they want better war, they should improve their defense. Now, in Dickerson's case, it's difficult, and I've spoken to him about this, and it's been an adjustment for him. But he understands, obviously, they've got a great outfield. So I have thought about war and how things will evolve over time. The one thing I will say is the people who are kind of in charge of these statistics, I don't know if that's the right way to put it, but the people who kind of monitor these things, they are always adjusting. And they never say, Fangraphs, Baseball Reference, Baseball Prospectus, they never say war is an absolute metric. They basically say it's an approximation of total value. No one pretends that it's the complete answer, or no one should pretend it's the complete answer. People do, and that's a mistake. So the DH thing for a guy like Dickerson, yeah, that's a little unfair. It might even be unfair for certain other players going forward. But if you're a better defender, you're going to get on the field as a defender, and you wouldn't face that particular penalty. So interesting question, good question, but I don't see that being a problem with war going forward. And keep in mind, too, as we look at war and other statistics, people might say, well, whoa, what about this change in offense? What are we doing here? How do players deal with the fact that a 660 OPS or whatever it is might be league average? Well, it's always context, right? And you have to compare yourself to the league. And in fact, when we were talking to Gabe Kapler yesterday, the Giants manager, the Fox broadcast team was talking to him. He mentioned that in talking to his players, he's saying to guys like Brandon Belt and Brandon Crawford, who do not have their career norms at the moment, statistically, hey guys, you can't compare yourself to 2021, 2019. No, you have to compare yourself only to the rest of the league because that is the context that matters this particular season. So these things evolve over time, but I just don't think the DH aspect that you mentioned there is going to be something that gets adjusted to that degree.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
One more question. It comes from voicemail.
Hey, Ken and Tim. This is Noah from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I haven't traveled to a whole lot of ballparks, but I've been to Cleveland, obviously living in Pittsburgh. I've been to PNC Park hundreds of times, and I'm heading to Baltimore Kendall Stomping Grounds this summer. It got me to thinking, Ken and Tim, is there a specific type of food you'd like to get at certain ballparks? You know, I always have to get a hot dog and the ballpark mustard, their spicy brown mustard out in Cleveland. And I'm really looking forward to having a crab cake at Camden Yard. Is there something specific you have to get somewhere or any suggestions you guys might have? Thanks, fellas. Enjoy the show.
Go ahead, Tim.
Okay, I have some thoughts. My first thought is, and I'm not saying don't get a crab cake in Baltimore, for sure, but I do think that sometimes when you consider a city specialty, you shouldn't necessarily go with that specialty at the ballpark. Like, if you're going to Philadelphia, don't think you have to get a cheesesteak at the ballpark because you're going to get a better cheesesteak outside the ballpark. You're going to get a better crab cake outside of Camden Yards than you're going to get at Camden Yards. So check out what's at the ballpark. Don't go with the city specialty. That's my first word of advice. As far as favorites for Baltimore, Ken, and I used to make quite a few trips down to Baltimore for work and for actually for to check out games. But I would always go with Boog's Barbecue out in right field beyond, you know, in front of the warehouse in right field. That was my go-to there. The ballpark I've been to the most in my life because I grew up there is Fenway Park. And Fenway Park, the go-to is always the Italian sausage with peppers and onions. So those are two of my favorites. I mean, there's so many different things at so many ballparks.
The food at ballparks has never been better. But I would agree with Tim that if you want a crab cake in Baltimore, I don't know that Camden Yards would be the place I'd go. Now, I will say in Philly, if I'm not mistaken, they have Tony Luke's. One of the
they do, and yeah, they didn't
places.
When it opened, but, okay. But they do now. You're right.
So they've
got
that there now, and that's legitimate. That's a legitimate Philly cheesesteak. So, okay, now I'm going to let you in on a little secret here. It's not necessarily something you want to hear, but here goes. In my time strictly as a writer, I would sample the foods. Sure, I had a blast doing it. And Boog's Barbecue for me in Baltimore is the ultimate. I love Boog's Barbecue. I love pit beef in general. That's a Baltimore thing. It's awesome. The other thing I liked a lot was the Cha-Cha Bowl at Oracle Park, the Orlando Cepeda stand. Amazing. In my role now on television, I don't eat at the ballpark anymore because once I get wired up, I have a wire in my ear that's attached to something on my belt. And once that all happens, you really can't go to the bathroom, so you really can't eat. So after every game, I'm starving, but by then, the ballpark is closed. I got to go eat somewhere else. So I haven't had the sampling that in years past I've had. I know Citi Field has great food. Seattle, I remember when I would go there frequently when the Orioles were good way back in the 90s when they were playing and the Seattle was good in the early 2000s, I'd go to Safeco frequently. Safeco had great food. San Francisco, great food. And I'm sure I'm missing some and I apologize for that, but I don't have a recent barometer because I've stopped eating at ballparks essentially.
You mentioned Citi Field. The Pat LaFrieda steak sandwich at Citi Field is phenomenal, although I think it cost almost as much as your ticket. So there's, you know.
Problem. And I would wonder, getting back to Tony Luke's in Philly, and again, I'm not talking with any degree of expertise or knowledge here. My guess is a cheesesteak at Tony Luke's at Citizens Bank Park costs more than it does at the actual place, which is about, I don't know, not even a mile away in South Philly.
Right. All right. Great questions. And it was fun ending that one up with a fun one. But have a great time in Baltimore. Camden Yards, such an amazing ballpark. So have a good time there, Noah. If you want to get involved on the next episode, email us at tabaseballshow@gmail.com or like Noah did, call us 646-543-7072. Coming up next on the feed, Starkville on Tuesday, Jason Benetti, White Sox broadcaster, joining the show. And if you've been paying attention to baseball this weekend, a wild weekend with the Yankees and White Sox, unfortunately, in the Bronx. I'm sure we'll be talking to Jason about that and everything else. The Peacock games he's doing on Sunday mornings, breakfast in baseball, lots to get to with Jason, so check that one out. And then great baseball all week long. The Roundtable on Wednesday, 3-0 show Thursday, and DVR and Law on Friday. If you want to save on The Athletic, you can do it right now. $1 per month for 6 months right now for all the great writing across all the sports. It's theathletic.com/baseball show to get that deal. Ken, have a great week.
You too, Tim. Thank you.
All right, we'll talk to everybody next week.